Before we dive into today's episode, I wanted to share a free resource that could help you or someone you know wrestle with one of life's biggest questions. Does it make sense to believe in God? This compelling chapter from Why You Can Believe takes on today's top scientific and philosophical objections and reveals three clear reasons why belief in God is entirely rational. Whether you're exploring faith or equipping someone else, it's a must read. And it can be yours today for free. Download your free copy now at premierinsight.org/resources. Again, that's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast. Before we dive into today's episode, I wanted to share a free resource that could help you or someone you know wrestle with one of life's biggest questions. Does it make sense to believe in God? This compelling chapter from Why You Can Believe takes on today's top scientific and philosophical objections and reveals three clear reasons why belief in God is entirely rational. Whether you're exploring faith or equipping someone else, it's a must read. And it can be yours today for free. Download your free copy now at premierinsight.org/resources. Again, that's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Well, hello and welcome to another episode of Matters of Life and Death. As always, I'm Tim Wyatt and I'm joined by my dad, John Wyatt. Hi, Dad.
Hi, Tim.
I'm really pleased to say that we have a guest on the show today, which is Luke Arredondo. How are you, Luke?
I'm very good. Happy to be with y'all.
Oh, it's really good to have you on the show. Thanks so much for joining us. For those who haven't come across you before, would you mind giving us a kind of potted biography, a little explanation of who you are, what you do?
Yes, my name is Luke Arredondo. I'm the executive director for the St. Brendan Center for Evangelization and Spirituality in the Diocese of Pensacola, Tallahassee. So that's in Florida in the U.S. I've been here for about a year in this capacity. I lead retreats. I offer parish missions and workshops. And then I run a retreat center. I also worked in the Diocese of Tyler, Texas for 5 years. I was in charge of faith formation for that diocese. And I have a little bit of experience teaching high school theology at a Catholic high school, working at a parish for 5 years. And then I've taught in an adjunct capacity at some universities. And I did my PhD in comparative religious ethics, but I wrote a dissertation about Leo the 13th. So I think that's what got me the invite for today. So I'm looking forward to diving into some of that with y'all.
Brilliant. Well, that's right. That's a little clue about what we're hoping to talk about today. It's we were basically very intrigued when our new Pope, Leo the 14th, explained that he had picked his name in honor of the last Pope to carry that name, Leo the 13th. And suddenly all the journalists like me were sent scrabbling to Google to try and find out what they could find out about this Pope they'd never heard of before. at least I will confess I'd never heard of him before, but it was really intrigued from my early Wikipedia searches. particularly when the new Pope, Leo the 14th, started saying a bit more about some of the reasons why he picked that name. But before we get onto our current Leo, let's wind the clock back to the late 19th century. I always get that wrong. 19th century, 1800s. Could you explain to us a little bit about who Pope Leo the 13th was and why is he such a significant figure?
Sure. Yeah, so Leo the 13th was the Pope from 1878 to 1903. The Pope prior to him was Pius IX, and Pius IX convoked Vatican I, the first council hosted at the Vatican. And we've had a number of ecumenical councils, but this one met at the Vatican, so that's why it's called Vatican I. And during Vatican I, the formal definition of papal infallibility was given. And Pius IX had a certain style that was very, you know, emphasized the authority of the Pope. So when he died, there was a very big toss-up about who would be the next pope, what direction are we going to go in? Do we get one of Pius IX's closest friends who will continue this trend? Do we get someone who's more of an outsider? The cardinals couldn't agree, and Leo the 13th seemed like an outside candidate, someone who wasn't really in the inner circle of the Vatican. And they thought, well, we'll let him be the pope for a few years, kind of give us a chance to settle after, you know, this very, you know, singular focus on the papacy and Pius IX. Let's pick someone that's a transition pope. So they elected him, and then to their great surprise, he got much more healthy and vigorous, vibrant, and he lived for 25 years. So the time frame was really significant because of the connection to Vatican I, which met in 1870. But then he was a prisoner of the Vatican. He couldn't travel. There's a lot of political turmoil during his papacy, and so he turned to writing encyclical documents, letters that would be sent across the church, as a way of sort of exercising his office of the papacy without being able to go visit even locally in Europe. He wrote 86 encyclical letters, by far the most of any pope. I think I can pretty safely say double any other pope in history, almost more than every pope in the 20th century combined. Like, it's close. And so that really shapes significantly the way the pope is treated and the expectations that come with any new pope. When Pope Francis wrote his first encyclical, everybody thought, okay, now we can look at what are this guy's ideas? What is he interested in and concerned about? And we're in that position now with Leo XIV. We want to see his first encyclical letter so we can sort of see his mind. This is one of the heritages of Leo XIII, was to give us this kind of new sense of the importance of the Pope issuing teaching by documents. He also, wrote an encyclical on the Bible, the first one, believe it or not. 1893 was the first time we had a Pope write a lengthy letter about the Bible, how it's read, how it's interpreted. He wrote an encyclical about the renovation of Thomas Aquinas, which was very significant in 1879, called Eterni Patris. He's probably most famous for his contribution to Catholic social teaching, which started in his papacy, started with a document called Rerum Novarum in 1891. I wrote a little whole dissertation about it. I might go on for a super long time, but that's some highlights for now.
That's brilliant. That's really helpful background. And we're definitely going to come back to Rerum Novarum as it's a really critical document connecting the two Leos. But just
Sure.
quickly on kind of papal names, we all kind of know that popes choose a new name when they become pope. Is it always as a kind of expression of what kind of pope they hope to be? So are we reading too much into Leo XIV choosing Leo when he maybe just likes the name Leo?
Yeah, no, I don't think at this point we can look at a papal name selection and think, oh, this is just a curious thing. He picked this name. I mean, it clearly means something. Francis was the first Pope Francis. And believe it or not, we hadn't had a Francis prior. Even all this time, we've never had popes named Francis. And I think you could see immediately he's concerned with evangelization. He's concerned with ministering to the poor, and certainly that bore. I mean, we have witness to that in Francis's papacy. So maybe 7 centuries ago, you could just say, well, it's a family name, or whatever. I think today it's a clear signal, and I completely lost control of my emotions and excitement when I heard Leo XIV. I heard it in Latin, and my Latin's not great, but I was able to intelligibly, infer. That's he just said Leonem Decimum Quatrem. He said Leo XIV. I lost it because I spent all this time writing about Leo XIII. So yeah, it's clearly a signal, and he's just said as much. In the first few days, he said, "Yeah, this is what I'm doing." So yeah, it's a little quirk for Catholics. What's the Pope's name? And it's just like sort of predicting the future by his name.
So Catholic social teaching, I mean, again, many people listening to this podcast would only have the haziest notion of what that means. I mean, there isn't really such a thing as Protestant social teaching. So what's Catholic social teaching?
Yeah, I like the way you put that there's no such thing as Protestant social teaching, and I would say maybe that's because there isn't a Protestant social teacher who's a singular person, right? That can kind of embody, like, this is what we're doing, this is what the program is.
Right.
So I think of Catholic social teaching as being, and I mean, I'm not the only one that thinks this, it's sort of a branch of moral theology, right? So we have moral theology. Classically looks at the development of virtues, avoiding vice, growing in holiness, following the commandments, living the Beatitudes. Those sorts of things are kind of classic hallmarks of moral theology. Catholic social teaching fits into that picture in an interesting way because the commandments are very clear about what is required, what is necessary. The Beatitudes challenge in a certain way to go beyond the minimum requirements. Think of the Sermon on the Mount. You have heard it said, but I say to you, Catholic social teaching is a sort of a unique category in that it's clearly giving reference to moral situations and problems, but it's not giving concrete solutions or things that are going to be sort of binding forever. Right, so it is teaching in an area where there is a lot of change, but trying to develop principles that do not change, that are based on divine revelation and sacred tradition. So it's looking at questions that impact the modern world, frequently that have a very moral sort of edge to them, but that can't be dogmatically proclaimed on in the way that you can say you shall not murder. Here's exactly what that means, right? So just as a toss-up example. You know, the question of a just wage is clearly important for society. It clearly has moral implications for employers, for the state, even for individuals as they're trying to sort of wrestle with what they do with their career. But you can't define what number qualifies as a just wage because so many factors are involved, so many things change. So in fact, Leo XIII is, you know, made a great contribution to that particular question of the just wage in Rerum Novarum, which I know we'll get to later. But does that help as sort of a kind of a sketch?
Yeah. And is it fair to say that Catholic Church teaching is kind of born in the papacy of Leo XIII, or is he building on kind of an evolving corpus of teaching from previous eras?
Yes. I think that's an excellent question. Frequently, people will say, just as they're sort of either introducing Catholic social teaching, you know, like an introductory level course at the university, or in a parish presentation or something, Catholic social teaching started in 1891, but nobody serious really means that there was no form of this teaching at all. He invented it. I think Matthew 25 is a great example of Catholic social teaching about the duties that we have to the poor, to those in prison, to the sick, all of those sorts of things. So the church fathers certainly contribute certain wisdom about the teaching of the gospel. We call it Catholic social teaching and we point to 1891 because it began to take a very unique kind of form. And critically, as Catholics, other popes would later write documents on certain key anniversaries of the publication of Rerum Novarum and point back to it. So, in a certain way, Leo XIII gives it to us in this sort of concrete way as entering into a social question in a very, you know, very bold fashion to say, is, you know, here's some things that the economy has led me to think about these questions. Here's some Catholic reflections on it. But then other popes point back to it.
And is it the historical context that is of relevance here? I mean, for is this related to, I don't know, industrialization, sort of development of modern economy, relationships between employers and employees, capitalism, and so on? Is that relevant to what's going on here?
For Leo XIII, or you mean
Yes.
Leo? Yes, yeah, absolutely. And in fact, the cardinal at the time, I think his last name was Manning. I think he was a cardinal in London, somewhere in the UK. You know, he intervened with Leo XIII. I don't know if he went to visit him. Of course, Leo couldn't go anywhere, but certainly communicated with him about the very real problems that the Industrial Revolution was causing in his territory in particular. So Leo XIII did not simply on his own decide, I'm going to write a document about this question. He was actually, I don't want to say harassed, but very strongly encouraged by particularly the bishops in the UK. You've got to say something. We're trying, but if it comes from you, maybe it goes further. Maybe it means more. So yeah, the changes that were wrought to the economy, to the fabric of society, by the Industrial Revolution were, you know, things that didn't start in 1891, but you were starting to see consequences, I think, in a pretty profound way. Leo writes, or one of his biographers writes about him riding on a train in, I think, the 1860s, that he was marveled at the speed that modern man could propel himself, and it was going like 30 miles an hour.
Yeah,
But he's
quite.
writing this letter about how there's this limitless change that technology
Yeah.
is bringing, and so you could sort of see it early in his life. He saw electricity become, a major function. I mean, so much of the world was changing, and the Industrial Revolution was kind of the engine for it. But then it was causing all sorts of other social problems, and so this motivated with the Cardinal Manning's sort of cheerleading, motivated Leo XIII to get into the conversation in a public way.
A lot of people, including those who aren't Christians, will have a perception that the Catholic Church has always been this reactionary traditional force, and surely it must have been on the side of the bosses against the workers in this kind of increasing social divide that you have in as capitalism gets underway. You have the masses of the urban poor drawn to the factories, laboring in often quite
Yeah.
poor conditions, and then you have the growth of the trade union movement. And everyone, I think a lot of people in this, not being unfamiliar with the story, would assume, well, I'm sure the Pope came down on the side of big capital against the workers. Is that right? What exactly, how did Rerum Novarum kind of sketch out a middle way, as it were?
Yes. That's an excellent question, and a sort of a good intuition. I think, I mean, a fair intuition. The church was very close with powerful figures in Europe for centuries, and a lot of the institutional structure of the church was only made possible because of wealthy landowners and this sorts of thing. And so it's all the more interesting, therefore, that Leo comes down and wants to say very clearly to employers, you have a right to treat your employees with more justice than you are. And that even so, one of my favorite lines is it's something along the lines of, even if a man is willing to agree to a wage that is very low, that does not therefore excuse you as the employer for letting him accept it. Just because he's willing to take it doesn't mean it's an acceptable practice for you to pay people, extremely low wages. So he does, though, as you said, Tim. He's trying to find a middle way. I don't think it's because he's trying to keep wealthy people happy, but because he's trying to adequately acknowledge that the wealthy have something positive to give to the world, but that the poor also have things that they deserve and are owed, and to try and bring these two together, in a way different from Marx saying, well, it's just a problem, and you have to revolt against this class of people. He doesn't want either class to hate the other, but he wants to sort of guide them to a more healthy relationship.
And so he kind of says, as I understand it, various things about, as you say, employers must pay fair, just wages, but Christians have the right to form trade unions and join them and to kind of
Yes.
lobby for their rights. And also they have Christian workers should have the rights to have time off for church and for family life as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So a few key things that he lays out in Rerum Novarum. I mean, you hit on many of them, but just to add a little bit more depth, he wants to say that employers, of course, have a duty to pay their employees a just wage, and he defines a just wage as an amount that will allow a single person in a family, and he assumes this is going to be the father. That the father can work, and he alone will be able to support his family by the merits of his work and of his wages, and that if he is reasonable with the way he spends that money, he should be able to save for his own security into the future, so that at some point he's not dependent on that job. Like, the idea seems to be for Leo, employment at a factory or wherever ought to be a stepping stone to be able to be self-sufficient later on as an owner. He then also says, even where you have someone that's not interested in leaving an employment, they like their job or whatever, the owner ought to share the benefits of ownership with his employees. So allowing them, I mean, some of the ways we think about this in modern times is profit sharing, co-responsibility in some way of sort of the future of the company. Leo's advocating for that in 1891, that an owner should not be the only person who's ever going to have benefit from the work of all these laborers, and that the work of the laborers should be beneficial to them beyond just their wages. So a responsibility, a share in sort of profits, that kind of thing is something that Leo sets in motion. And I also like your mention of, free time for worship. Very, very big deal for him. And this is one of the reasons why he said we need unions, is to allow the workers to sort of defend their selves and their own rights.
I mean, it's very interesting to put it in the context of the Industrial Revolution, particularly in Britain, isn't it? Because, the mill owners were sacking the men and employing children
Yes.
because they were better at troubleshooting the machinery, and it's fascinating. I'm really unaware of this, but it's fascinating to imagine some Roman Catholic cardinals sort of aware of this, seeing the
Yes.
pastoral fallout in their flocks and feeling deeply disturbed about this, and the church as a whole, the Catholic Church and the Pope in particular, must intervene, must say something.
Yeah, there's a great pastoral concern, right? So it's not just a theological motivation. It is really animated by a pastoral concern. He writes about children and women not being forced to endure employment in these dangerous conditions. And there you see him, really, really greatly emphasizing the fact that human beings, even if they are children, they are due dignity and should not be treated as a means to profit. Whether they're greater at fixing the machines or can work longer hours or whatever the benefit is to the employer, that cannot be the sole lens that they use to make their decisions about how to run their businesses. So it's a fascinating document. I mean, he upholds property rights for individuals, but he also is very stern about capital, cooperating more with labor, sharing in some of the benefits of ownership. So it's so very difficult to pin him in. And this is one of the things as a Catholic you'll see, I'll see some people that they love Leo XIII, they love Rerum Novarum, and their kind of one slice of it is he said the owners have to treat their employers better. And this is, so we're going to lean in just on that. And then there are other people that say, yeah, I love Rerum Novarum because he upholds property as a right. So we're going to get real excited about that. So you can, it's almost, it's a sort of a Rorschach test. Like, how do you read that document that you love so much? Which has been interesting too with the new Leo, the name selection, seeing the different kinds of crowds within Catholic circles that were excited about it and why they were excited. I think they're excited for different reasons. I don't know. We'll see how they play out.
It's very interesting historically, isn't it, as well, because he's not the only Christian voice. I mean, here in the UK, we're often taught a lot about the Victorian era and how there's these like pivotal social reformers. You get people like Florence Nightingale helping invent kind of modern nursing and improving conditions for soldiers in wars, and there's various other names, William Wilberforce, who helps get rid of the slave trade. But there are a few other people who are particularly influential in passing reforms, kind of banning, children under a certain age being in down the mines, and basically gradually improving the social lot of industrial Britain. And a number of those were doing so quite explicitly because of their Christian faith. I think people like the Earl of Shaftesbury and think people like that. And yet I don't recall ever coming from the institutional Church of England, the kind of powerhouse of British Christianity. It was left to individuals, even if they were kind of powerful individuals. So it's fascinating that this is actually coming from the very top, from the Vatican down, saying, hang on, this revolution has gone too far, and the kind of inherent God-given dignity of people is being kind of crushed by a push for profit at all costs.
Yeah, particularly if you think of him, as you describe it, a prisoner of the Vatican, so in one sense totally isolated from, and it's in this opulent surroundings, no
In his
doubt,
pa gilded palace.
in this gilded palace, and yet here he is really concerned partially for what's going on, thousands of miles away.
Yeah, it is a fascinating thing to think of him trapped there. I mean, just to give a little bit of flavor to the reality of the fear that was on the ground, at his time. When Pius IX died, Two notable things. There was a funeral procession with his body, and it was there was protests and attacks, and it was like a it was kind of a dicey situation, very dangerous, because Italy had just recently become a state, and there was a lot of animosity. You know, the papal lands had been sort of decreased drastically, and then because of that, the cardinals that were preparing to elect the next pope, they had a debate about whether they should get out of Italy for their own safety, so that nobody was pressuring them to select one or another candidate. And their judgment was, we might have greater safety if we left to do the election. We might not get back in if we elect elsewhere. So they decided to stay there. But yeah, that is a fascinating perspective too, about kind of the social, the wider social context of kind of advocating for change. I know, you know, newspapers and editorials and reporting were very big, you know, impact, and particularly with respect to slavery in the UK, like that. And so Leo, you know, actually publishing and writing and sending encyclicals to newspapers. He did interviews with some newspapers. And one of them, I can't remember which, was an Italian newspaper, that the guy came to the Vatican, of course, and he thought he was going to have an interview, and instead Leo just kind of told him, I'm writing an encyclical, this is what it's going to be about, I'd like you to tell people about it, you know, get him ready for when it comes out. And he did an interview with a French Le Figaro. A woman interviewed him, and that was the last kind of solo interview he did, but he did some of them. Right, so he is using, if you will, modern technology, the press, to sort of spread his message. That's just a fascinating story all around.
This month only, Premier Insight is giving you an exclusive pre-release teaser to John Lennox's brand new book, God, AI, and the End of Humanity, only available to the Premier Insight audience. In this powerful resource, Professor Lennox, a renowned Oxford professor and leading Christian thinker, explores the rise of artificial intelligence, biblical prophecy, and the spiritual challenges ahead, grounded in scripture, not speculation. It's a must-read in our culture, and it's our thank you for your gift to Premier Insight, helping believers like you stand firm in truth, even in an age of digital confusion. You can give now at premierinsight.org/matters of life and death. That's premierinsight.org/matters of life and death to receive your special teaser. Thank you. This month only, Premier Insight is giving you an exclusive pre-release teaser to John Lennox's brand new book, God, AI, and the End of Humanity, only available to the Premier Insight audience. In this powerful resource, Professor Lennox, a renowned Oxford professor and leading Christian thinker, explores the rise of artificial intelligence, biblical prophecy, and the spiritual challenges ahead, grounded in scripture, not speculation. It's a must-read in our culture, and it's our thank you for your gift to Premier Insight, helping believers like you stand firm in truth, even in an age of digital confusion. You can give now at premierinsight.org/matters of life and death. That's premierinsight.org/matters of life and death to receive your special teaser. Thank you.
You're listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
And to kind of fast forward a little bit then, as much as we could dwell on the church history, one of the other things I understand he was trying to do was kind of push back against the other answer people were coming up with to this social question, which was the kind of socialist communist response of let's overthrow the bosses and establish a dictatorship of the proletariat. And clearly he says, well, no, property rights are a thing. You know, I'm not
Yes.
encouraging the Catholic faithful to rise up in armed revolution, unsurprisingly. But then the kind of the other big chunk of the kind of social teaching about responding to the plight of the poor that we're aware of from Catholicism would be liberation theology. You know, almost a century later, coming out of South America, you have quite a different flavor of this, you know, priests and bishops on the ground seeing the plight of their flock and coming up with a slightly different theological response. Could you just explain a little bit about how liberation theology does it differ from the kind of Rerum Novarum approach? Is it a development of it?
Yeah, it's a good question. To be fair, I'm not a very good
Sorry, I've thrown you in
expert.
this. I have put you on the
No, that's
spot there.
okay. It's not like I can't say anything, but liberation theology is far from a specialty of mine. I will say, particularly like in Nicaragua, you see in some of the situations there with respect to liberation figures, I mean, they're taking urgent positions, right, about crises. And it's hard to fault them for seeing the urgency of solving some of the problems and some of their responses. I would say in terms of like the broad scale of Catholicism, liberation theology is looked at as sort of a curious episode, as sort of a curious field in that there was pushback from John Paul II, from the church, and sort of trying to limit some of the political dimensions of it. Not to say people as Catholics can't have political action, but that it's not a requirement of the gospel, and that there is some sort of separation there that's necessary to keep our categories clear. Yeah, I mean, so that's basically what I sort of see as in terms of that question. It does relate, though, right, to concern for dignity, concern for justice, freedom. So those things aren't altogether off the mark. But I would not characterize liberation theology as like unofficial development of the Catholic social teaching tradition in the way that the other papal documents are, because they're promulgated, on anniversary dates and with very sort of clear intention. You mentioned the Marxism thing, communism. Of course, Leo XIII is interacting with some of that, but actually, within the Catholic social teaching tradition, it's Pius the 11th, I think it's the 11th, the 1943, Quadragesimo anno, 40 years after, or four, sorry, 1930, 40 years later, after 1891, 1931, he brings that dimension of it more into focus. It's not that Leo doesn't do it, but Pius later gets much more specific with it, maybe because it was a growing problem still, like Leo's intervention didn't solve that crisis completely. And that's one of the other interesting things about the whole wide scope of Catholic social teaching is you begin to see themes which return, but which have to be treated differently because of changing contexts. So there's always, for instance, an emphasis on human dignity. There's always an emphasis on subsidiarity, on solidarity. But those are going to look differently depending on the questions and the problems that people are facing. And so what you see is, it is a moral question, but it's not a moral question that has an answer like a math problem has an answer. So these are very complex. They're almost all involving either politics or the economy, or sometimes the political economy, and that's never settled. That's going to move, that's going to continue to shift. So you have fresh reflections, fresh interventions.
Yeah, so what's really interesting to me is the parallel here with, we come, Tim and I, from a Protestant and mainly evangelical perspective, but there's a very similar process which I have been involved in ever since I was a student about trying to engage with this constantly changing modern
Yes.
world from the historic Christian faith, but in our case, including, so going all the way back to the Church Fathers, but also including the Reformation and the subsequent centuries. How do we take the historic Christian faith and relate it to this weird stuff that's going on in our world? And of course that is constantly changing, and there's this constant challenge and of a dialogue and
Yeah.
between these two forces. And in a way, this is the analog of that within the context of the Catholic ecosystem.
That's right. And that concept of dialogue is really critical. Pius the Ninth, who was the Pope preceding Leo the 13th, he was not interested in dialoguing with the modern world. He was interested in sort of building a fortress, in sort of proclaiming the Syllabus of Errors, right, is his treasure. he wanted to just make very clear the distinction between what the church is about, what the world is about, and they're not the same. And Leo really wanted to engage in a dialogue with modernity, with the modern world, to open communication. So one symbol of this, he made Newman a cardinal. Newman had some different views on theological issues than Leo XIII privately held, but he saw his value to the church in the modern world. He made him a cardinal. He opened the Vatican secret archives to scholars for study and for scholarship. And that had, that was a big change. He sold the last boats of the royal of the papal navy. He sold a collection of slippers that Pius IX had built up. Some just funny things I remember from my research. I don't know what kind of slippers they were, but it was some that you could sell. So
You only it's only on matters of life and death you're hearing about papal slippers. You know,
papal
here we
slipper
go.
collections.
This is we're extending our reach dramatically here.
Absolutely.
Can we cut forward? Can we cut to the chase and come to Leo the 14th, who I take it is not selling his papal slippers?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, so I mean, Leo the 14th, so far, fascinating figure. I've read many, not every single one of his homilies and speeches, because now they're starting to rack up. Those first few days where it's still new, he's not on the schedule yet. It was easy to keep up with everything that he was saying. But a fascinating figure in that he said very publicly, I selected the name Leo the 14th in to honor the heritage of Leo the 13th. And he mentions Rerum Novarum, but then intriguingly has said, and I am thinking of a new industrial revolution, and that is the revolution of artificial intelligence. He's mentioned this on at least two occasions, and one of them was the day after he became the Pope. And it's just sort of my intuition, if you become Pope and you're giving your first sort of public comments, you're not going to be scrounging for something new to be interested in. You're going to be talking about something you've spent years worried about, right? This is going to be something that's deep in your heart. And so that's very intriguing. He's also a younger Pope. I think he's 68, 69, which is young for a pope. And I think that's very helpful because he's closer than the 85-year-old cardinals or 80-year-old cardinals would be to seeing the way technology is just changing.
And
You
he
know, it's,
comes,
I mean,
yeah, and he comes from Chicago. I mean, he's Bob from
yeah,
Chicago.
that's right. That's right. He just did a speech at the live stream. I mean, how modern is this? The Pope live streamed in to Chicago White Sox Stadium for his first sort of American visit. And it wasn't the Cubs because he's not a Cubs fan. He's a White Sox fan.
Shame.
He said that publicly.
I bet Leo XIII in prison in the Vatican would have loved Zoom. He was trying to get out there, you know. I cannot be with you in person, but I'm going to pipe myself in like 1890s versions of Zoom.
I'm going to be
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I want to read out that quote that you mentioned because it's actually just really fascinating. So this is the second or third day since he's become Pope. He's talking to the College of Cardinals who've just elected him. And he says there are various reasons why he chose the name, but quote, mainly because Pope Leo XIII, in his historic encyclical Rerum Novarum, addressed the social question in the context of the first great industrial revolution. In our own day, the church offers to everyone the treasury of her social teaching in response to another industrial revolution and to developments in the field of artificial intelligence that pose new challenges for the defense of human dignity, justice, and labor. So he's picking out those three key themes: dignity, justice, labor, that you said are kind of like run through the stick of rock that is Catholic social teaching. But fascinatingly, he specifically names this industrial revolution in artificial intelligence as one of the most pressing issues that literally stands behind his own papal name, which I just find absolutely intriguing.
I think this comparison with the first industrial revolution is really fascinating, isn't it? Because you know what happened in that first industrial revolution was a complete reversal of the agrarian way of life and all those century-old traditions, and this enormous disruption So of this mass move to the cities, the it's an extraordinary phenomenon, but it's taking place over what 50, 80, 100 years. I mean, a slow but
Right.
extraordinary revolution. So, and the parallels, I mean, and of course this is nobody knows what we, is what's happening with AI equivalent? Will history see it as the same kind of complete disruption of normal working practices? He clearly is on that side, even at this relatively early stage, predicting it's going to have massive social consequences.
Yeah, of course, I've taught at some I teach in adjunct capacity every now and then, as the opportunity is offered to me. And just in the last 2 years, grading papers, it has been a complete change for me at what I see. And the most succinct way to put it is that now, when I receive a very obviously badly written paper, it's the only time I know this student did this work themselves.
Yes,
And
quite.
that's so weird.
It is.
It's just such a strange place to be in. So, in terms of a revolution, I know it seems Leo's, our current Pope, very concerned with the economic, the labor implications, and I don't deny those for a second. To me, I want to hear, this is just, on my wish list. It, whenever he gets his encyclical written, whenever that comes out, I want to hear a lot about the epistemological concerns of artificial intelligence. How is it changing or challenging what we call knowledge? And how do we maintain a human and a humane sense of what it means to learn? Because that, to me, has the biggest, it scares me the most about what the future might look like in 30 years when we think all we need to do to know something is just ask, some computer. I mean, and even asking Google or going to YouTube for things now or 10 years ago, even that's not the same as really learning and studying, but it's like a helpful tool. I have the sense that younger people, especially, really imagine that there isn't any use to know something. So you can just ask ChatGPT, so what's the function of knowing? And that's a major revolution. And then, if we think of the Industrial Revolution and sort of the response of the communist or Marxist bent, that said, there are problems with work and we have to overthrow it this way. I don't know what it would mean to say that we don't have to worry about knowing anything anymore. And what might be the solution to that? What character might come in and say, "Hey, you don't want to bother with knowing anything? I got you. Here's the scary, dangerous answer." But yeah, it we'll have to watch. We'll have to see. I don't think though it's going to take 80 years, right? I think everybody's seeing whatever happens, it's going to be faster than that.
And I think it's like he's raised very high expectations, hasn't he? I mean, no pressure, but we're looking to you for the answer to this sort of completely mind-boggling developments that are taking place. Science fiction coming true. Okay, over to you.
Right.
What's the answer? What's God's
Yeah.
answer?
And I wonder who will be involved whenever, I mean, he's going to have to write something. I mean, I think that's pretty much unavoidable. And I don't think he's shied away from that. He comes right out of the gate talking about the revolution of artificial intelligence. You got to figure he's ready to get to work on something, right? I wonder who are the figures that will be in that conversation with him. So, in Leo the 13th's time, an encyclical is published. I don't think anybody who was well informed imagined the Pope wrote every sentence of it, but we didn't have much of an awareness of the fact that there were other figures associating with him, helping him with the drafts, doing research. That's a little bit more hidden. The works out there, you can find, the names of people that were involved if you really dig. I think today, for him to issue an encyclical on something like that, I want to know who are the tech people he's going to be talking to. I can't remember the guy's name that kind of really started ChatGPT, and he doesn't seems to speak a lot about how he doesn't like it now. He's always issuing these warnings. I wonder if he'll be something that he talks to the Pope or Jeff Bezos or whoever.
I think you're right. And of course, I mean, I'm deeply concerned about the lack of interest in from church leaders. You know, it feels as so often historically, church leaders, I mean, both Catholic and Protestant have been so obsessed with issues of human sexuality as though these are the central issues of our time that other extraordinary technological developments, which in the light of history may turn out to be far more consequential, almost seem to get no awareness at all. But on the other hand, I have huge sympathy with church leaders. I mean, as I'm wrestling, trying to think, you know, how do I try to use what resources I have to reflect from a Christian perspective, from a historic Christian perspective. You know, when I'm dealing with issues, as I often have done, of issues of matters of life and death, is where the podcast gets it told, you know, things like abortion and euthanasia and reproductive technology. It turns out that actually the church fathers have been discussing this for 2,000, you know, for 2,000 years ago. That actually these are part of conversations that have been going on. But the church fathers are remarkably silent about intelligent machines, you know, and the epistemology
Augustine
of
never got
knowledge.
around to large language models, unfortunately. Bit of a lacuna in Aquinas there.
So it feels almost like you are starting on a blank piece of paper, you know, that you're having to create ways of thinking about this new technology, this new, obviously there are connections with the past, but it's not immediately obvious, you know, how you do that.
Yeah, I think here this is where, you know, a Catholic social teaching model gives you some stepping stones, right? So there's, you know, several themes of Catholic social teaching. I probably don't have them all memorized, but you have like human dignity, you've got solidarity, subsidiarity, the universal destination of human goods, family life, I think like political freedom. I think there's a couple more, and you know, people kind of slice it up different ways, but those sort of major broad concepts are what underlie all of the Catholic social teaching documents from the popes from 1891 up to Pope Francis Fratelli Tutti, which was 2021. And so when you just think in those terms, these are goods that have to be upheld. Okay, how does this new problem interact with some of these goods? It gives you something more than starting from absolutely from blank. It doesn't give you the answer necessarily, right? But at least it helps you to put it into a framework of, okay, these areas of concern seem to be the main ways in which human beings as social animals interact. If these things are all good, society is good. How does this new problem threaten or enhance, you know, these sort of different themes? But yeah, even Chrysostom doesn't tell us how to handle large language models, you know. He was great with his words, but he doesn't know how to deal with computers' words.
One of the things you mentioned, Francis, earlier, he's very famous, particularly outside the Catholic Church, for one of his first encyclicals, Laudato Si, about the environment, and kind of set his stall out in the first few years as Pope for being, you know, the climate change Pope, the one who's concerned about the environment, and kind of kickstarted this incredible kind of ecumenical environmentalist movement. And I think, perhaps to not be surprised, it had quite a lot of impact beyond the church circles. People are saying, well, hang on, you know, this is significant. It's in the build up to the Paris Climate Accords. Do you think if and when in the next few years Pope Leo XIV lands an encyclical on AI, it could have a similar level of impact beyond simply Catholics themselves who'll be reading it with interest? Do you think the world is interested in what a kind of elderly 70-something American bishop has to say, you know, has to
Bob
say
from
about AI.
Chicago.
Bob from Chicago has to say about AI.
Yeah, well, I do I think there are segments of our population right now that are already deeply concerned. And you know, to maybe to the surprise of your listeners, I don't have in mind primarily, you know, Christian parents who are trying to homeschool their kids and shelter them from the world, although those people are certainly worried about it. I know a lot of educators, university professors, high school, elementary, on all kind of different walks of life, different parts of the US. And I think educators are have been sounding the alarm already for a while, and they see the just frightening trends of how students think about acquiring knowledge, and what it means to do work. So I think that there's certainly got to be some segments of just sort of tech industry people that can see some of the writing on the wall. So I think there will be interest. I don't know if it's going to shift anybody's behavior. That's very difficult for me to predict or even to expect that a pope says something and then lots of people jump and do what he asks, you know. But I think the effort of making the public witness is still worth it. And you know, it sometimes surprisingly works. I mean, Leo XIII didn't solve the crisis of the Industrial Revolution, but he set a lot of things in motion very, very, very clearly, and then gave Catholics and other Christians sort of a foundation for getting involved. And I think I've read some of Leo's speeches talking to young people about the way social media has impacted their life, about how loneliness has increased, and he wants to invite them, and he does invite them, like, listen to the voice of the Holy Spirit, listen for God who is calling you. Like, there are voices beyond those of social media that are interested in you. We're in the church. We are interested in you as young people. We want you to feel at home. So it's going to be, it'll just be a fascinating thing to watch. Certainly Francis made waves. I don't know how the world's going to react to continue to react to an American pope. That's just so hard for me to see them. Oh, well, this guy's American. Let's listen to what he says. You know, I feel like it's he's going to have to really work for it.
But then he's almost as much Peruvian as he is American, right? This is what
Well,
is so
that's true. He
fascinating
does
about
have
him. He spent
Peruvian
so much
citizenship.
time molded in a completely different context, doing kind of missionary work in Peru. So I think he's a really interesting kind of bridge character across the Americas. And you know, speaking as a non-Catholic, I was encouraged by a lot of Francis's papacy because he seemed he wasn't, you know, you talked about the previous, I think was it Pius the Ninth, kind of trying to build a fortress around the church and protect
Yes,
it from the
yes.
world. Whereas Francis had this kind of open-hearted, you know, he talked about wanting a poor church for the poor, to be humble, to kind of strip away some of the institutional finery and say, let's see what the church can, how the church can serve, how the church can open itself up to listen to others. And it see from the very early days, it strikes me that Leo XIV might be more in that Francis mold in trying to say the Catholic Church isn't just about battening down the hatches. It's about saying we've
Right.
got something to offer. We've got something that both people of other faiths, other denominations, other flavors of Christianity can listen to, but also people of no faith at all.
Yes, in his first homily, he talked about the need to proclaim Jesus Christ to people who find him irrelevant or absurd, that it's not necessary because they've got their own power over their own life, or it's just doesn't even deserve consideration on its face. So he's, and he has emphasized repeatedly the role of listening, the role of listening to the questions, concerns, the problems of those in the church and those outside of the church. So I think you're absolutely right. And he's been very forthright about, I mean, if you just, for instance, looked at all of his writing so far, how often has he mentioned Pope Francis? It's very frequent. He is trying to tell people, I am not trying to completely change the mold of the papacy. But at the same time, he's an individual person. He's got his own style, his own, you know, interests. I don't think that it's going to look like nothing has changed here. But certainly that spirit of being open to dialogue, he is very clear so far that he intends to continue that. I think he'll address different issues, different topics. When I guess if you're the Pope, no one can tell you what to focus on unless it's those British cardinals just harassing you to write about the Industrial Revolution.
I've been going on for a long time. I have one final question, if you'll bear with me, Luke. We talked a
Sure.
little bit about Catholic social teaching on numerous occasions. I think for Protestants like us, and there's a lot of people listening to this podcast, we will be Protestants. Should we take a second look? Shall we, or maybe even a first look? Is there kind of treasure? Is there gold in there that even if for those who might not share exactly all of the kind of Catholic Church's presuppositions, that actually there's real helpful material, theological foundation, stepping stones, like you said, for when we're trying to wrestle with whether it's the classic kind of moral, ethical questions, abortion, euthanasia, both of which have kind of erupted again in the UK to public debate in recent years, or other things, newer questions. Do you think Catholic Church teaching should be kind of taken a bit more seriously by Protestants and other Christians?
I certainly do. I'm very biased in that respect. Have working for bishops, but sincerely, I have found reading the Catholic social tradition has really opened my eyes to the complexity of discernment and pastoral accompaniment. One of the big terms that Francis used over and over was accompany. We have to accompany people, walk with them, and I think that looks very different than just knowing the commandments, or than just observing, for a Catholic, observing the sacraments and the precepts of the church. But to be able to encounter people where they are dealing with the problems that they're dealing with, the Catholic social teaching tradition gives you sort of a framework of how to engage in these sometimes very complex, messy conversations. There's obviously 1891, Rerum Novarum, a good place to start. But if you wanted to look at maybe just one document that's not 1891, Gaudium et Spes, the joy and hopes of it's the pastoral constitution on the church in the modern world is the English title, but Gaudium et Spes is the Latin title. It was from the Second Vatican Council. It's very long. But it gives us good sense of how the church tries to look to the modern world to see the good that it's capable of, and also the risks that are kind of tangled up with some of those goods. And that's I think is helpful for any Christian. There's a famous Catholic American radio host. He died just a couple of years ago. His name was Al Cresta. I don't know if you've heard of him, but he used to say at the start of his show, like the theme music would come on, and he'd say, "I'm sitting here with the New York Times in one hand and the Catechism of the Catholic Church in the other. Let's get started for ready for conversations of consequence." And I think that's what Catholic social teaching tries to do in a less silly way, is look through the lens of the gospel to the problems of the modern world and find ways to get some balance and to get some discernment principles. So yeah, I think there's a lot there. For any Christian, and one of the things that I think you'll find interesting about it, if you're not, coming from a Catholic perspective, is the frequency with which the scriptures are the source of the key ideas. In fact, you can look, the church has what's called the Compendium of Catholic Social Doctrine or Catholic Social Teaching. I forget the official title. It's on the Vatican's website. It's free. The first two major sections of it are just going through the scriptures and the church fathers before it gets to any contemporary questions. And that shows you kind of the groundwork that we're trying to build on. So, yeah, I would encourage anybody to take a look at the compendium and Gaudium et Spes.
We should certainly put that in the show notes, shouldn't we? I'm
Definitely.
sure there will be people who are interested. I'm certainly interested, and I think this is a very helpful reminder of the riches of that tradition.
And it's fascinating you mentioned that Catholic radio host because regular listeners will know many, many times one of my dad's heroes is an evangelical Anglican vicar called John Stott. And he had this famous idea of double listening, which was that you hold the Bible in one hand and the newspaper in the other, and you listen
Yeah.
and you listen to what God might be saying through both and try and bring them to bear. So yeah, a very, very
Oh, it's
similar
great.
idea. There you go. Catholic double listening. Well, let's wrap it up there. Thanks so much, Luke. It's been brilliant having you on the show and sharing some of your knowledge and expertise. Any final thoughts, or is there a website you don't want to point people to, or can they read your dissertation on Leo the 13th? Has it been published?
If you have access to the right database, but I tell you what, for listeners of this show, if you just reach out to the host here, I'm happy to send a copy of the
That's very kind. There you
PDF. What a
go.
special offer for MoLab listeners
It's
only.
going to be Leo the 13th fan club
Yeah, we'll start a
is
spin-off podcast. We'll work through all the popes backwards. How many have you got? There can't be that many, right?
266 more.
Oh, wow. Okay, maybe not. All right. Well, thanks so much, Luke. It's been a great conversation. And thank you, everyone, for listening.
Absolutely.
If you'd like to find out more about what Dad's been writing and speaking on, you can go to his website. That's johnwyatt.com. And if you'd like to read some of my journalism, you can find that on my website, tswyatt.com. And in particular, I would point you towards my Substack newsletter, The Critical Friend, which you can sign up to for free. Otherwise, please do keep your questions coming in. We love to hear from listeners. Any thoughts on what we've been talking about with Luke today, about AI, about the Industrial Revolution, about Catholic social teaching? We'd love to hear your response. You can email us MOLAD, MOLAD, at premier.org.uk. But also, if you've got suggestions for other guests we could invite on or other topics we should cover, please do get in touch. Otherwise, we'll be back next week with another episode. But until then, bye-bye.
From Premier Unbelievable.
Warning, the following ZipRecruiter radio spot you are about to hear is going to be filled with F-words.
When you're hiring, we at ZipRecruiter know you can feel frustrated, forlorn even, like your efforts are futile, and you can spend a fortune trying to find fabulous people, only to get flooded with candidates who are just fine. Fortunately, ZipRecruiter figured out how to fix all that. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. With ZipRecruiter, you can forget your frustrations because we find the right people for your roles fast, which is our absolute favorite F word. In fact, 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day.
Fantastic.
So, whether you need to hire 4, 40, or 400 people, get ready to meet first-rate talent. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/zip to try ZipRecruiter for free. Don't forget, that's ZipRecruiter.com/zip. Finally, that's ZipRecruiter.com/zip.